This is the letter on emotional sobriety that Bill W. wrote and that appeared in the Grapevine of January of 1953. And that was before I was born. That is so exciting. As I get older, I don't say that as much anymore. And emotional sobriety. I think that many Ulsters who have put our AA boost cure to severe but successful tests still find they often lack emotional sobriety. Perhaps they will be the spearhead for the next major development in AA, the development of much more maturity and balance, which is to say humility, in our relations with ourselves, with our fellows, and with God. Those adolescent urges that so many of us have for top approval, perfect security, perfect romance, urges quite appropriate to age 17, prove to be an impossible way of life when we are at age 47 and 57. Since AA began, I've taken immense wallops in all these areas because of my failure to grow up emotionally and spiritually. My God, how painful it is to keep demanding the impossible, and how very painful to discover finally that all along we have had the cart before the horse. Then comes the final agony of seeing how awfully wrong we have been, but still finding ourselves unable to get off the emotional merry-go-round. How to translate a right mental conviction into a right emotional result, and so into easy, happy, and good living. Well, that's not only the neurotic's problem, it is the problem of life itself for all of us who have got to the point of real willingness to who to right principles in all of our affairs. Even then, as we who away, peace and joy may still elude us. That's the place so many of us AA Ulsters have come to be. And it's a hell of a spot, literally. How shall our unconscious, from which so many of our fears, compulsions, and phony aspirations still stream, be brought into line with what we actually believe, know, and want? How to convince our dumb, raging, and hidden Mr. Hyde becomes our main task. I've recently come to believe that this can be achieved. I believe so because I begin to see many benighted ones, folks like you and me, commencing to get results. Last autumn depression, having no really rational cause at all, almost took me to the cleaners. I began to be scared that I was in for another long chronic spell. Considering the grief I've had with depressions, it wasn't a bright spot prospect. I kept asking myself, why can't the 12-step work to release depression? By the hour, I stared at the St. Francis prayer. It's better to comfort than to be comforted. Here was the formula, all right, but why didn't it work? Suddenly, I realized what the matter was. My basic flaw had always been dependence, almost absolute dependence on people or circumstances to supply me with prestige, security, and the like. Failing to get these things according to my perfectionist dreams and specifications, I had fought for them. And when defeat came, so did my depression. There wasn't a chance of making the outgoing love of St. Francis a workable and joyous way of life until these fatal and almost absolute dependencies were cut away. Because I had over the years undergone a little spiritual development, the absolute quality of these frightful dependencies had never before seemed so starkly revealed. Reinforced by what grace I could secure in prayer, I found I had to exert every ounce of will and action to cut off these faulty emotional dependencies upon people, upon AA, indeed upon any act or circumstance whatsoever. Then only could I be free to love as Francis did. Emotional and instinctual satisfactions, I saw, were really the extra dividends of having love, offering love, and expressing love appropriately to each relation of life. Plainly, I could not avail myself to God's love until I was absolutely able to offer it back to him by loving others as he would have me. And I couldn't possibly do that so long as I was victimized by false dependencies. For my dependence meant a demand for the possession and control of the people and the conditions surrounding me. While those words, absolute dependence, may look like a gimmick, they were the ones that helped trigger my release into my present degree of stability and quietness of mind. qualities which I am now trying to consolidate by offering love to others regardless of the return to me. It seems to be the primary healing circuit, an outgoing love of God's creation and his people, by means of which we avail ourselves of his love for us. It is most clear that the real current can't flow until our paralyzing dependencies are broken and broken at depth. Only then can we possibly have a glimmer of what adult love really is. If we examine every disturbance we have, great or small, we will find at the root of it some unhealthy dependence and its consequent demand. Let us, with God's help, continually surrender these hobbling demands. Then we can be set free to live and love. We may then be able to gain emotional sobriety. Of course, I haven't offered you a really new idea, only a gimmick that has started to unhook several of my own hexes at depth. Nowadays, my brain no longer races compulsively in either elation, grandiosity, or depression. I have been given a quiet place in the bright sunshine. Bill Wilson. And with that, I'll turn it over to you guys. Steve, June.
Thank you, Yvonne. And thanks for reading that. And I probably should have done that at the beginning. I know that's your way of telling me to stay on topic. But I love that. And actually, my intention is that that there are several passages in there that I want to reference as we go forward and talk about a little bit as they pertain to me and as I kind of understand and interpret them. So I appreciate you reading that all at once for us. I'm going to let June start us off this session. We're only going 4 hours, and I'm committed to giving June at least 38 minutes of airtime. So.
Thanks, Steve. My name's June again. I'm an alcoholic. I was reading recently an article that I might read you a couple of lines from that was written by one of my favorite long-timers, Cliff Roach, from Oceanside. And he had written this article for his local San Diego central office intergroup. I'm going to read you a couple excerpts from it in just a few minutes. But I was thinking about the guy who sent me this article that I had not known that Cliff had written. He also has been sober quite a while, and he was telling me a kind of a funny story. He said he was working with sort of a new guy, and the new guy was telling him about some situations that were coming up in his life. And he said, when I'm dealing with these situations, he said to his sponsor, he said, I'm trying to do what Jesus would do. Trying to think about it the right way and do what Jesus would do. And his sponsor said, why don't you just try and think about doing what an adult would do? Because you're setting the bar awfully high there on that, you know? And I think that, you know, that gets back to this idea where when in that article that you were just reading, Yvonne, you know, like we want to be the best, the most perfect, you know, we're always setting that bar really, really high. And sometimes it's just those baby steps, you know, of just being an adult. And you know, there's there was a woman that I got to know very well, named Sybil, and she was the first woman to get sober west of the Mississippi. And she was just an amazing member of Alcoholics Anonymous. So when she passed away, she died with 57 years sober. And at that time, she was the longest living sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now we have many people who have more, time than that. But at that time, she did have that. And someone was telling me they drove her to a meeting and she was going to be the speaker. And before the meeting began, she said, I'm going to pop into this little empty room right here. I just want to say a little prayer. And the guy who was driving her, they popped into this little room and she just said the simplest little prayer. She said, you know, God, help me give an average talk tonight. And I just thought, an average talk. I mean, I have never thought of asking to do anything average. You know what I mean? I want to do an amazing, I want, you know, people to remember me for, I want to save somebody's life. I mean, I don't want to just be average. But the thing is that, you know, it talks about in our literature, becoming a worker among workers, becoming a member of the family rather than the dominant, you know, this idea of, you know, of that kind of unity, you know, that we can, that we strive for. And so in this article by Cliff, and it's called Grow Up. I'm not going to tell you I'm not going to read you the whole article, although it's not that long. But he talks about, you know, when he was fairly new, he was driving with his sponsor and he was telling his sponsor that he's very sensitive. And his sponsor said, no, you're not. You're an immature SOB, which of course then hurt Cliff's feelings all over again because he was very sensitive, you know. But in this article that Cliff is writing at the time, he's, I think, 29 years sober, he says. And he's writing and he says, I agree with Bill Wilson, who said that one of the number one characteristics of the alcoholic and one of our worst character defects is self-obsession. And he said that, you know, Cliff said at 29 years sober, having worked with a lot of guys and having heard a lot of inventory and having, you know, all of those different experiences, that he agreed with Bill that this is one of our worst character defects, that idea of self-obsession. That being so, then what do we need to do in order to get rid of, you know, that self-obsession? And I believe that one of the main things that has worked for me and that has helped me consistently throughout the years is this idea of being of service, of working with others, of thinking of others, of seeing what I can add. And, you know, there's a story in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. When I was a year sober, or less than a year sober, I was at my home group and I went to lots of meetings. I live in Southern California, so we have a lot of meetings. I'm very fortunate. And when I got sober, I had no place else to go but meetings. I did not live in a regular place. I didn't have a TV. I didn't have any relationship with my family. So if I wanted to go indoors, I went to a meeting. And I usually got to the meeting early and helped set up. And I stayed until the last person was leaving. And then I went to coffee with whoever. And then I would hitchhike or walk home or whatever, just to fill in my time. So I had, you know, a lot of time. And when I was in this meeting in my first year, I was at my home group and this woman spoke and she was giving her talk. But at the very beginning of her talk, she said, I'm not asking this, I'm just telling you, this is what she did. She said, can I see the hands of all the people in this meeting who have read the entire big book of Alcoholics Anonymous cover to cover? And I had not, so I didn't raise my hand. And I looked around the room at my home group, and I would say about half of the people in the room raised their hand. And I'm sorry to say this, but I'm pretty sure some of them were lying. Okay, so there was a certain number that had read this. Now, as I said, I had not. And I didn't know how often this woman was going to speak. I was going to 21 meetings a week, you know, for that first 2.5 years. And my ego said, I am never going to be in that meeting when she asks this question again, where I cannot raise my hand. And so because of my ego, I read the entire big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, not to get spiritually elevated or to be a better person or, you know, any of the reasons that, you know, you might hope that you would, just so that I could raise my hand. I want to let you know that 48 years later, no one yet has ever asked that question again. But I read the entire big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. The thing that was, you know, really great about that, separate and aside from the fact that I read the book, is that I was keeping a lot of there were a lot of chapters in the big book that I was skipping because they really were not relevant to my particular case. You know, I was not a wife and I didn't have a wife. So I wasn't going to read that chapter. I didn't have a family afterward. My family didn't want anything to do with me. So I was just skipping that. I didn't really have a regular job. So I wasn't going to read that employer's part. You know, I mean, there were just a lot of parts that didn't, you know, really work. And sort of, again, like Sandy Beach used to talk about, I would kind of flip through the book looking for the chapter on how to make money, you know, maybe how to get a boyfriend. I mean, you know, things that seemed relevant to me rather than anything else. But in reading that, I found one of my favorite stories. I think about it a lot. It's from the family afterward. And it is a story about when father, who we will call the alcoholic, When Father gets this spiritual answer that we have provided for us, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we begin to have that transformation and practice a life with these principles where we're trying to be of service and add to the world, at first, he's going to want to hug that gift to himself. He doesn't want to tell anybody or share it. He's almost afraid that if he says too much, he'd lose it. But eventually he realizes that he has struck a limitless lode that is going to continue to pay dividends for the rest of his life, which is a pretty good deal. Dividends for the rest of his life, provided that he gives away the entire product, which I'm telling you, even today when I read that, I think the entire product, I mean, shouldn't he keep like half or, you know, a third of it himself? I mean, what about a prudent reserve? But the thing is that in Alcoholics Anonymous, we get to see over and over that we have to give this away to keep it, that something that was given to us for fun and for free is something that we need to continue to pass on. And then we get these dividends, you know, that for the rest of our life, and they continue to pay. And I, you know, I am overpaid beyond anything that I could possibly tell you, even with all 4 hours. You know, if you just had me just talking, I couldn't tell you all the amazing things that have happened in my life. So that's it for where I'm going to start there. And I'll turn it back to Steve for a little while.
Thanks, June. You know, when you were just talking about that limitless load, that we can't seem to run out of what we're giving away in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's so counterintuitive. I've spent so much of my life trying to be self-satisfied, and self, as it turns out in me, is insatiable. Self cannot be satisfied, but when I turn it around and when I begin to offer to you what it is I want, it's amazing how I become satiated, how I become satisfied. That's a term that, you know, June talked about that beginning of the 12 and 12 in the Ford, where it talks about that I will have this life that is happily and usefully whole. And I too love the word happily, but I have come to believe that what makes it happy is that it's useful. And that's what was different than before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. And the story in the big book that earlier in the earlier chapters about Fred, that many of you know, at the end of it, Fred says that while his that he had found a life that was infinitely more satisfying and he believes useful than the one he had before. And I believe, again, that is the usefulness, that the purposefulness is what makes for the satisfaction. You make me think, June, of the story I'd read in a book. And of course, it was years and years ago. And there were two brothers who farmed land and for grain. And at the end of every day's harvest, they split the grain up 50-50. And each took that day's harvest. And one of the brothers was married with a family, and the other brother was single and had no family. And so the brother without the family began to think, you know, my brother has a full family. It's not fair that we're splitting this 50-50. He deserves more. He needs more. They have more mouths to feed. So every night, late at night, he would gather up some of the grain and take it over to his brother's storehouse and empty the additional grain in the storehouse. The brother with the family thought about the fact that that his brother lived alone, that he had no one, that he was going to need that when he got older, he was going to have no one to care for him while he had his children to look after him. So he took the grain every night to his brother. And one night as they were walking, they ran into each other and, of course, embraced. They were both trying to give it away, yet they could not lessen their harvest. To tell a Cliff Roach story that why it's so hard for me to get that, because June made me think of Cliff. And years ago at a men's retreat I was at, Cliff told a story. He was 38 years sober at the time. And he said at 38 years sober, he had learned three things that were absolutely absolute truth for sure and for certain. And he said, the first is, number one, is that surrender never looks like a good idea coming up on it. He said, number two, never had surrender not served him well. And number three, he could never remember number two the next time. And I think that that's what happens. I've got a body of work that tells me that surrender to these spiritual guidelines, that surrender to doing the next right thing, that surrender to a God-directed rather than self-directed life, never has that not served me well. Yet I stand like a kid at the end of a high dive every time, afraid to jump. And anyway, you know, I said I wanted to refer to some of the reading. And so when Bill talked about the fact, and as Yvonne was reading a few minutes ago to get us started, when he said that perhaps these oldsters who put the booze cure to good test will spearhead the next major development in AA. And it says the development of much more real maturity and balance, which is to say humility. Now, to me, first of all, in Bill's writings in the 12 and 12, what I've noticed, and you probably have, is he feels, because he's writing to people like me, which means that he has to put these adverbs in there, right? He can't say humility. He's got to say real humility. He's got to say genuine humility. Not the version that I'm used to. Other places you will see him talk about true leadership. You will see him talk about real honesty. In other words, he's talking about the real deal. And I've been bringing some manufactured humility light to the table. You know, there's the great line in the 12 and 12 that says, we thought a proper display of honesty would get us by in life. I don't want to be honest. I just want to be perceived as honest. I want to be just honest enough for you to think I'm honest. I want to be, I'm that guy that will tell you the truth about me, tell you something that is true about me, and you will go, I cannot believe that he's willing to share that. And you have no idea what's behind the curtain, the thing I'm not willing to pull out. So a proper display of honesty, and Bill is talking about what would the real thing look like? What would real maturity, real humility look like? And it says, because he describes me, I was 47 years old the first time I read this, and my daughter was 17. And when he talks about that need for top approval, for perfect romance, for perfect security, you know, I don't want the average amount. Like I said, I need to be overserved in all these areas. And that's appropriate to the 17-year-old. But it is unattractive on the 47-year-old and the 57-year-old. And last Saturday, I turned 67. So I'm sitting here 67 and often going out into the world with the same kind of demands and wants and needs that a 17-year-old might. And when I take a look, it is embarrassing when I catch myself. It's even more embarrassing when my wife points it out for me before I've had a chance to see it myself. But you know what? But we have to be willing to look at these things and go, whoa, sometimes I don't even see it. It says that these adolescent urges that so many of us have for top approval, top security, perfect romance, they prove to be an impossible way of life. It doesn't say that it makes life difficult. It doesn't present a challenge. It's impossible. You know, my sponsor, Don M. from Louisville, who some of you on here might know, Don talks about, and see, I believe, as I said earlier, we're talking about the unmanageability of our life. And Don reminds me that the step says my life is unmanageable. it is not difficult to manage. If my life were difficult to manage, the solution would be to be a better manager. It would be to try harder. It would be to do better. But my life is not hard to manage. My life is unmanageable. If I go out here when we're done this evening and jump in my car to go to the convenience store and my power steering is out, with hard work, concentration, and effort, and 10-2 on the wheel, I can still make it to the store and back. But if I get out there and the battery is dead, that car is undrivable. I can't think my way into it. I can't read my way into it. I can't good intention my way into it. I can't make that car go until I get the necessary power. And I show up at this emotional sobriety when I am emotionally unsober, when I am suffering from the emotional hangover. It is because I have been operating on self. And when I operate on self, it's an exhausting way to live. And again, I often don't even know it sometimes while it's happening. June talked a little while ago about reading that book, being ego-driven to read the book. And I'm a firm believer that there's no wrong reason to do the right thing. What happens, because if you're drowning and I happen by and have a life preserver, but I notice a news crew has pulled up and I can't wait to make the 5 o'clock news, and that the appropriate crowd has gathered, that I then local hero saves a frizzy-headed, red-headed woman drowning, my friend June. June doesn't give a damn what my motives was. She's just saying, get me out of this lake. I'm going down. So she doesn't care. But what happens is my experience of that seems to be different. My experience does seem to be impacted. How I have the experience seems to be impacted, whether I'm doing something out of love and courtesy and kindness and a genuine humility, or whether I'm doing it out of selfishness. It doesn't change the act. It doesn't change who got helped, but it certainly does influence my experience of that. And so that came to my mind as well. The other thing that we talked about and that we hear a lot in AA, I certainly do, and you probably do in Al-Anon as well, the phrase that what other people think of me is none of my business. Because, see, I have operated so much of my life in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous with what other people thinking about me being critical. And the phrase that what other people think about me is none of my business, I don't believe means that I don't care what you think. Let me be clear. I care what you think. I would prefer to be liked and appreciated and respected and well thought of. But I think what that means is that when I've adopted this design for living that encourages me to have my actions dictated by principles rather than thoughts and feelings, that I act based on the principles as laid out by Alcoholics Anonymous, and the conclusions you draw about me are out of my control. I don't know what that looks like to other people. But I'm encouraged to live by principles rather than by my feelings or my thoughts. And what I have found is that the 12 steps and the principles embodied in them always point spiritual true north. They don't always look like their spiritual true north, but they point that way. And the thing is I had my sponsor years ago when I was living in Richmond, Virginia. I've got a couple of Richmond friends that are on here with us today. I had spoken at a meeting one night. I talked just about as long as I've talked here, but it was not a speaker meeting and I had not been invited to speak. And I got home and I called my sponsor, Joe, who had been in the meeting. And I said, Joe, did I sound self-righteous in that meeting tonight? I'd begun to worry about it. And he said, oh, Steve, you're still asking all the wrong questions. He said, because the question isn't, did you sound self-righteous? The question is, were you self-righteous? He said, but the truth is, you don't care whether you were self-righteous or not. You're afraid they caught you. You're afraid they think you're self-righteous. And you're afraid that they're driving around going, man, that Steve's a self-righteous son of a gun. Well, he said, you don't care that you have the defect of character. You're worried about what the defect looks like on you. And that is, in fact, the truth. There was no noble reason. I just wondered what you thought. And he said, here's the news. He says, you are not who you think you are. And you are not even who they think you are. But you are especially not who you think they think you are. And see, I've been spending all my time taking actions based on what I think you'll think. And it is really comforting these days to know that I'm wrong about what will impress you. I don't have to try to aim at that target anymore. I don't have to consider my audience anymore. I don't have to worry about who's looking anymore. I'm supposed to just do the next right thing. That's a line we throw out so much that it becomes trivialized. And man, that is a hard thing to do. Living a day at a time, doing the next right thing. Try that on for a week. You know, that is hard stuff right there. But I'm going to keep giving it a shot. I'm going to end with this portion and give it back to June, but with this story. Because the other thing I've discovered is I keep waiting and thinking that God is going to solve my problems. And I keep taking them. And what I have found is that often my problem gets solved in a way that I didn't expect or would not have asked for. And there was a story of this senior executive at a Fortune 500 company. And he was an excellent executive. He was competent in his job. He was well respected by everyone in the company. He only had one shortcoming or one challenge every week when he went in to meet with the CEO and deliver a report. He would wet his pants. And he was just unbelievably ashamed and embarrassed by the fact that that would happen. And the CEO was a kind, compassionate man. And he said to him, he said, you know, why don't you see the company psychiatrist and maybe you guys can get to the bottom of that problem. He was very kind in doing it. And so the VP said, sure. And he left. And during the week, he went to see the psychiatrist. Then he came back when it was time to deliver his report to the CEO again. He walked in, and as he walked in, once again, there it goes, and he pisses himself right there in front of the boss. And the boss said, man, I guess you didn't get to see the psychiatrist. And he said, no, I saw him. And he said, well, I'm sorry that it wasn't very helpful. He said, no, it was great. He solved my problem. And the CEO goes, what do you mean, man? You just wet yourself right here. And he went, yeah, but I'm not embarrassed about it anymore. And see, that's what's happening. Am I trying to really solve my problem or am I looking for peace of mind? And I think this emotional sobriety is about me finding peace of mind that is independent and not dependent upon the circumstances of my life. It often is, but it doesn't have to be. Jim, pick it up, please.
You know, a lot of the time in the early, in my early years, I was a problem case. And so I'd get sent to see Chuck C often. And Chuck would talk for hours. And I didn't have a car, so somebody would have driven me there. And he would just talk for hours, 2, 3, 4 hours about these spiritual ideas. And it was like he was speaking Latin. And he was not really, he never would address, you know, the problem I had, which was, I had several, but, you know, I was being deported for being illegally in the country. And he never talked about anything about that. He would just say, things like, we can't think our way into right living. We have to act our way into right thinking. And I'm like, well, what about the immigration? Do you know what I mean? It's like, this is, you know, it's trying to get these old timers back. And I don't know, you know, any of you who've had a sponsor and have had those kind of conversations where you're trying to get some practical information. Sometimes it's like you tell them something and It would be like you walking up to them and going, excuse me, what time is it? And they go, it's a horse. I mean, they're not really helping. And it'll usually be something like go to a meeting and try and help somebody else and stop thinking about yourself. You know, when you really need to get back to this issue. But Chuck would also talk about the fact that, you know, he came into the program with as many related disorders as anybody else ever gets to the program. And he said, I haven't spent any time working on those related disorders. You know, my first priority was to stay sober. And if sobriety doesn't come first, you can't have it. And if sobriety doesn't stay first, you can't keep it. And then he would talk about, you know, that throughout the years that we stay sober, the ego is always going to come back. There's no way that we can get rid of the ego. It will always come back. And he said, but it is like the burr under the saddle. It's going to be the thing that is going to make us uncomfortable enough that we need to make changes. And that has been, you know, my experience. Again, the ego will come back in a way that I don't necessarily recognize it as ego at first. It takes a while, but again, that discomfort, you know, that feeling, that burr, you know, under the saddle, where I end up having to do something different. And, you know, truly, I'm not always delighted about the fact that I need to do more work. You know, I'm not always grateful. Oh, great. You know, I get to dive deeper and, you know, learn more about myself. I, you know, frequently my reaction is, I mean, how could I be at this spot after having worked these principles for this long? I mean, did I do it wrong the whole time? And I think that the answer is no. I don't think I did do it wrong the entire time. But I do think that we get to different levels, you know. And I thought, you know, I mean, of course, my mind is always, you know, jumping around. But, you know, here's a form of, you know, self-centeredness that I have. And I'm sure Steve doesn't have it, and maybe none of you do. But for example, today, I'm going to be spending 4 hours, you know, with you guys doing this. And I do hope that I'm adding something, you know, that's why I showed up. So I'm going to be doing that. And the truth is that at the end of this 4 hours, I'm going to be kind of tired, you know. And then this morning, I talked to a couple of people that I sponsor, where I was trying to help and be of service to them. But the truth is that at 5:30, 6 o'clock, when this is over, I'm going to be a little bit tired. I just know that that's going to happen. And I share my life. I have the privilege of sharing my life with a guy who's also a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, who's been sober over 30 years. And tonight, what I'm going to hope to do is that we're going to have a little bit of, you know, some kind of dinner, and then we're going to probably binge watch some silly show. And as we're doing that tonight, one of his sponsees are going to call. And I'm just telling you, this is what I'm going to think. I'm going to think, oh, I mean, I am so tired. Can we just watch a show? Now, if my sponsee called, I mean, that's different, because this is my sponsee, that they need my help, you know. But all I'm telling you is that I still, after as long as I have been sober, am self-centered. I'm self-centered even about my being of service, you know, in the sense that, you know, this is what I'm trying to do. And I have to remind myself, now it's his turn to be of service. It's actually not convenient to me that he's being of service at that time. By the way, I'm in our bedroom today for this 4 hours, which means that he can't come up if he wants to change clothes, or if he would have liked to have taken a nap on a Saturday, or, you know, all the different things that he might like to do. And he doesn't bring those things up to me, because actually he is more mature than I am. I mean, it's an absolute, you know, truth, not always, but in a lot of ways. And part of that, I think, you know, is that I have learned to practice restraint of tongue and pen. So that tonight when his sponsee calls, I might roll my eyes, but hopefully I won't do it in a way that I can get caught. And I'm not going to say, you know, anything, because I have learned that his time is just as valuable as mine, even though in my mind and in my ego, I don't think sometimes that I'd like his service to be arranged around my service so that it doesn't interfere with my time, you know. And so these are the ways that I can still see that I have a lot of growth, you know, that I have that, that I need to do. About 3 years ago, one of my daughters, I have three, one of my daughters went through an extremely difficult time. She was having health issues that were undiagnosed, which then led to emotional issues. And it was really, really scary and really, really hard. And she was really sad. And I would say, I think it would be safe to say that there was some suicidal ideation going on that was realistic, you know. And she lived in another state, and I was traveling quite a bit to take care of her. At the same time, I'm an only child, and I take care of my mother. And my mother has 16 different doctors that I coordinate for her, because she does have a series of health issues. And my mother suffers from very significant mental health issues and always has. So there's a lot going on there. And meanwhile, at the same time that these two things were going on, Mark, the guy that I share my life with, he suddenly lost 30 pounds and had some undiagnosed issue going on. And we were seeing different doctors and specialists and trying to figure out what was going on. And, you know, so what I want to let you know is that as these things were going on, it was a bit overwhelming. And I was traveling, as I said, going back and forth state to state, trying to take care of, you know, helping with Mark and my mother, and then going back and helping my daughter. And all three of them were very sad and worried about things that were going on with their health and with these other issues. And I got an awareness that, first of all, I have been one of those people that has taken good health for granted at different times in my life. And I suspect maybe all of us have done that at different times. But I also came to see that as I was walking through these things, a reminder that there are people that are walking through these things all the time, you know, at different times in their life. And fortunately, many of these people that I knew who had walked through those kind of circumstances with one, two, or three members of their family, they were able to share with me again. And one of the things that became very important as I was trying to be of service with these people was that I take care of myself, that I get back to making sure that I was eating properly, that I was going to meetings, that I was doing what I need to do spiritually so that I could have the energy to be of service. And another thing that was very important during this time was I heard someone share in a meeting. And he shared about the fact that as we sometimes are walking through difficult times, even if they're not necessarily ours personally, but they're around with the members of people that we care about very, very much. He shared about the fact that his son had been very sick and was in intensive care with an undiagnosed thing at, you know, at like 11 years old. And it was really scary and it was life-threatening. And he said that he had called his sponsor, and he said his sponsor reminded him that we stand in the light when we are dealing with people that we care about who are really struggling. We stay in the light. We don't go into the darkness with them. You know, we stand out here in the light so that they can come back out. And so it was really important for me to remember, you know, to look for ways that I can do that, to see what I can add. But I don't go too far into that situation. Because then I'm not being of service. I'm not able to be. And I think that, you know, these are things that I have watched so many people in our program, you know, do over the years. I can remember one time I called Sandy. He lived in Florida. I lived in California. And I had a friend whose sister wanted to go to a meeting. And I called Sandy and I left a message because he wasn't home. I left a voicemail. And I said, "Hey, Sandy, I've got a new woman that would like to, you know, check out a meeting. I don't know how serious she is, but if you give me a number of a woman that I could, you know, see if she wants to call, and I'd really appreciate it." And I left that message. And about 9 o'clock at night, my time, which was midnight in Florida, I got a phone call from Sandy. And I go, "Hi." And he says, "Hey, June, I got a number for you." He goes, "I'm really sorry I didn't call you back." He said, "I've been in the emergency room the last 6 hours, but I just got home, and here's the name of this woman, and here's the number," you know. And I thought, you know, I mean, I think he was entitled to like feel sorry for himself or to be kind of tired and, you know, call me the next day or, you know, whatever. But the way that this service thing works, where we reach out to others and where we continue to try and bring light and to try and help, are things that the old timers that I have known, they have set the bar really, really high. And I am so grateful that they've continued to stay involved in Alcoholics Anonymous and to hold that light up, you know, and to, you know, to help pass on the torch, you know, for those that have, you know, that have passed away. So I'll turn it back to Steve and see what we do next.
Thank you, June. Listen, I thought we'd take the 15 minutes between now and the end of the hour and invite you guys to share, and we'll let Yvonne direct traffic up there with the mute and unmute button and give some feedback or ask a question. Then we'll take a 10-minute break and come back after that. But love to hear from some of you guys.
Yeah, so stick your electronic hand in the air. If you can't find your electronic hand, you can put it in the chat and I'll come and find you. If you wave in the picture, somebody will let me know that you're waving. Somehow we will get to you. So who wants to share about their immaturity? Better yet, who wants to share about how they're dependent on other people, places, and things? Or anything else that comes to your mind? Oh, we're all having mature people here. I know I'm not. Hello, Debbie.
Awesome. Hi, Debbie, I'm an alcoholic. And thank you both. And thank you, Yvonne, and everybody behind the scenes that's making this work and keeping us on track. And I just love hearing you both share. My husband's also in the program, and he's been on district meeting. It's like, can you not put your headset on? I don't even want to listen to him. Yeah. You know, it's like, maybe that's a little immature. Because I'm like, can you please be quiet now? Because I'm in my meeting. So, and I do, I have to blow it out of proportion in my mind. It may be really that big, but to be looking at, you know, I was not quite rational during that. No, you were immature. I mean, and just label it. Because when I go ahead and go, you know, it's not insensitive. That's immaturity. You know, it becomes a little more objectionable just a little quicker for me to look at, you know. And I've just enjoyed listening to you guys' stories, and I'm loving it and bringing up Cliff. You know, it's like even I know where Oceanside is now, you know, and I'm in Kansas and Texas, right, middle of USA. So it's great to hear your stories and all the memories of Sandy. I just and Don, I've just met him through Zoom, and I follow him around when he's speaking. So it's been just very cool with everybody being so available. And you guys are passing it on, continuing to pass it on. So thanks. I'm done, Yvonne, before you mute me.
Thank you. Kimberly.
There. Thank you. I'm from Southern California. Southern California. So I'm used to having special meetings, but not like this. This has been a pleasure. And most of all, because I'm retired and with COVID and all of that, I stay home. But it was really a pleasure because you guys kind of hit something in me, and that was the immaturity. And I have 6 years, and I sponsor, and I blah, 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 blah. But I started realizing I'm acting out in very immature ways, and I couldn't get a handle on it. You know, I just, that bugged me, and this bugged me, and I spoke to my sponsor. We couldn't really put our hands on it. But I do really have to take a look at immaturity. I think it's a key factor in a lot of things I do. And to have it blatantly shown to me like this was great, because I didn't know what was wrong with me. You know, that little tickle started itching. So I just wanted to thank you. I came on this totally by mistake, through another person, and I would like to be more involved in this. I mean, seeing from Ireland into Scotland and California, that connection shows me AA works. I know I'm going for a while, but I wanted to tell you that that's what keeps me coming back. AA works. If in Scotland and Ireland and wherever you're talking about, New Zealand, I can't wait to see the beautiful faces that just sit there and be. And I need to work on that. That's a maturity thing. But thank you so much for this. I want to know more.
Thank you, Kimberly.
Kimberly, I can't tell you how many people have listened to June and me totally by mistake. It happens all the time.
Sarah.
Hey, Steve and June, thanks. And Yvonne, you know I love you, girl. I have missed being on, and I am retiring. October the 10th is my last official working day, and I'm scared to death. But, you know, this immaturity, oh, Lord, I ain't going to tell you how much I stepped in it the past couple of weeks. But, you know, we have emotional slips. I have emotional slips, Al-Anon emotional slips. And I'm just so grateful for this topic. I really just needed to hear this. And I just appreciate you guys. Thanks.
Thank you. Ruben.
Hi, everybody. My name is Ruben. I'm in Fort Lauderdale. I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon for the last 2.5 years. And I was thinking about some of Steve's remarks about true humility and admitting our flaws. And my firm belief that the only distinction between you guys in AA and us is that we have addictions to other things other than substances. We want to control, we want to interfere in the lives of the people we love, and we try, like Steve so vividly explained, try to force managing situations and things that are completely unmanageable. So I want to share that I admit my total lack of maturity, because I'm stuck in step one, and I continue to come back to step one, but I know it's in my process, and I have to admit that I will learn at the pace that it's the right way, the right pace for me. So thank you so much, you guys, because you teach a lot. Thanks for being
here. Thanks, Ruben.
Thank you, Ruben. Happy you're here. Lola.
Hi, I'm Lola, and I'm an alcoholic. Hope June's still on here. June, this is really directed to you. So I was getting sober as a teenager, and everybody was old, and I couldn't relate in, and I was different, and I was an immigrant, and I just didn't fit. And, you know, I mean, and somebody, by the grace of God, gave me your tape. I know I've told you this story before, but someone gave me your tape, and I wore that damn thing out because I didn't see any kids in AA. There weren't any, except there was one June over in California, and I'm in D.C., a girl who's getting sober at 13. So what the hell's my problem? I was older than that. And I wore your tape out, and I got sober. And so if you want to die happy knowing that you affected at least one life, it has certainly affected mine in a very positive way. It's interesting to me to know that we've gone through such similar things. I'm 6 years behind you, but I think six, maybe five. Anyway, about 10 years ago, everybody in my family started dying, and they all ended up dying. And I was running around the Beltway, and I was doing all the cooking, and I was doing all the caretaking, and I was raising my son, and I, you know, going to work, all that crap. Oh, and going to meetings. I don't know how in God's name I did it. Honest to God, I don't have any clue how I did it. And yet, I think when we're about God's will, God gives us the energy. When we're about God's will and not interfering, like not making things happen my way, the way, when I'm just about God's will, it's smooth sailing. It might be rough, but you know what? No one ever died from lack of sleep. And I'm here to tell you, I've been making up for that lack of sleep. But anyway, you know, I mean, you get what you need here. And I don't know if that's maturity or not, but that's the way I saw the people before me act as sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous. They took care of their parents. And even though, you know, like you, I came from a very abusive situation and did not want to deal with all of that. And my mom was mentally ill and all that kind of crap. And I didn't, it was hard for me. It was really, really hard for me. Really hard in my sobriety, and yet God gave me the grace and the courage to do what it is that I had to do to be the best daughter that I could be. And so I'm very grateful for that. I don't know about maturity though. I really don't, because, you know, even though I'm doing this, all I want to do is run and find a cave. You know, I'm gonna be the original cave woman. Get me away from everybody. And now that we're in COVID and I'm caved in, so to speak, I want to get the hell out of here. Some people are never satisfied. Thank you both very much for speaking.
Thanks,
Lola. Thanks, Lola.
All right, Steve, back to you.
Well, we're at 5 minutes before the hour. Why don't we take a break until five after or so? And I would encourage you not to leave. This is when June said that she was going to bring the A material in hour number three. So that's where the keys to the kingdom are coming. So don't run off. Anyway, we'll take a little break. Thank you guys for at least feigning interest for a couple of hours. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve. All right. If anybody has anything to share or would like to say something, please do stick your hand in the air. We'll get to you. If you have any questions, put it in the chat. I'm still stuck on June talking about Chuck Chamberlain. I can't even focus on anything else right now, so I'm just going to say that. I'm like, she had to go to his house and he talked for hours and she didn't know what he was talking about. I'm like, oh my God, I want to hear everything he said. That to me is just fabulous. I've never had the privilege to meet Chuck Chamberlain, but we sure are familiar with his writings and his talks. Diana, don't go. Diana. Diana's going. No, she's coming back. Yes. What you got? Oh, there it is. A pair of glasses.
Well, you're right. You don't want to start name dropping with June. She'll win that one every time. So,
what else you got? What you got?
When I heard Vaughn say Chuck C, I had to go grab the book. Hi, I'm Diana. Let's do a bell ringer. The first issue of the AA Grapevine, June 1944, was published. The Grapevine was at first an 8-page newspaper, supposedly just for members in the New York area and those serving in the armed forces all around the world. For that year's December Grapevine, I, Lois, wrote a short account of my experience as the wife of an alcoholic through the drinking years and the early years of AA. I'm Diana, and that's the way it was. Chapter to the wives in the big book. We had begun to realize how distorted the relationships in the families of alcoholics could often be. Therefore, I had expected Bill to ask me to write the chapter to the wives, and perhaps the following one, the family afterwards. When I shyly suggested this, he said no. He thought the book, except for the stories, should all be written in the same style. I have never known why he didn't want me to write about the wives, and it hurt me at first, but our lives were so full that I didn't have time to think about it very much. I'm Diana, and that's the way it was. Thank you, Yvonne, and thank you, Steve. It's just been wonderful to listen to you guys. I love the story that you told when you got up to speak. And then you called your sponsor. I can't remember exactly what words you used, but that was just so me. You know, my happiness stemming from circumstances and outside myself is something I deal with on a regular basis. And I work on that today and every day. Thank you so much for you guys sharing, June and Steve. I enjoyed it so much.
Thank you, Diana. Thank you so much. Yeah, chapter to the wives. Lynn.
Hi, my name's Lynn. I'm an alcoholic. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
I just had put a question in the chat, and I didn't know if that was something that could be addressed now or later, but I love hearing examples of how ego can rebuild itself and be really sneaky and kind of sneak back in unnoticed, and June had mentioned that. I guess kind of both of them. And I didn't know if they had perhaps more examples, because it helps me when I see examples of things that I wouldn't necessarily attribute to my ego coming back.
Thank you, Lynn. And I'm sure Steve will address that or June right after this little break. Apparently, there is keys to a kingdom, so we're waiting for the keys. But he acknowledged your question, and I'm sure they're going to address it. Thank you for being here. Somebody says she cannot raise her hand, so maybe others can also not. If you cannot raise your hand, just put it in the chat. You can either put it to Yvonne or to everybody. I'll catch it. And then I will go find you and unmute you. That's another way of doing it. The blue hands are not always in the same place. It depends on the devices, but most of the time you can find them in the participants somewhere in the bottom there. Just click on those more or mute all button. By some people, it's in the chat. Too many different devices. I wish they would all make it the same, easier for me. But if you really want to say something, just say in the chat, I want to share, and I'll come and find you. It's not a problem. That's how we do it for those who are not skilled where the hand is on the computer. So what else do I have? I have Coralie in the bottom of my screen. How are you doing, Coralie? Coralie, can you hear me? You're unmuted. No? No? How can that be? That's not working. What can I say? I am waiting. Steve, I'm assuming you've got the timer on because Yvonne was slightly distracted. Hey, Kimmy. I see you. Oh, you got your hand up. There you go.
Hey, Yvonne. Thank you so much. It's so great to be back and to be here once again. I just want to thank you, a heartfelt thank you for reading the letter that you wrote. For me, I don't hear enough, and what I need to hear sometimes about the relationship between alcoholism for me and Al-Anon and depression. So I really appreciate hearing it from so many years ago. And it's really through this workshop, through this, you know, Without Borders, that I've heard about that so much. And I've heard the reality of it, and I've heard the recovery in it. And it's something that I struggle with personally myself. And I keep hearing, I'd love to hear more about people's experience with that and their recovery and the solution, focusing on the solution. And for me, what I'm hearing is my spiritual relationship with my higher power and being of service. So thank you. I can't thank you enough, because for me, it goes into a dark, hidden place and secret. And to hear other people speak about it, I just need to express my heartfelt gratitude and to hear the hope in your voice. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Kimmy. It's good to see you. All right. Okay, well, I'm ready for it, Steve or June, either one. And we had the question by, trying to find her here, Lynn. She put it in the chat. Steve, is that you?
Back. And I'm here.
Okay, Lynn had put a question in chat and was wondering if you could tell her more about that.
Me.
It's a little bit back somewhere.
Was that the one from Liz?
I think so.
Let me find it here so I can...
Basically, she wants to know more examples and how.
Yeah, Liz had asked about, I think, some subtle ways that ego may have shown back up. And unfortunately, with me, it's not always that subtle, but it does certainly rear. Sometimes it just bursts through the door like a SWAT team. But I will tell you a couple of things that a few years ago, gosh, it's probably been about 10 now, my wife's mother was ill and had been for quite some time. And she and Connie and my wife Connie's also 31 years sober and active in AA and a great AA member. And she and her mom had a very contentious relationship that's very hard for her. But she committed and was doing the things it took to take care of her mom. And then her mom passed away. And when her mom passed away, I rose to the occasion, which was not always the case, but I rose to the occasion and was good support for her and showed up in ways that historically I had not shown up. Okay. And I think, and she was appreciative and grateful for that. And flash forward a few years after that, and my mom became ill. And Connie came out one night. She'd been back in our bedroom, and she walked out to offer a suggestion. There was a question that I was kind of wrestling with on what to do around a situation with my mom. And Connie said, "Maybe you would want to," and I literally did this. I said, I got it. And shooed her out of the room. And she came back out a little while later, sad. And she said, "You know, I was just trying to offer to you what you had offered to me." She was, and this is a place where I failed to recognize, failed to see that I was in that ego state of thinking only of me, not willing or able to accept any help, but also just being dismissive and minimizing her attempt to repay what she viewed as kindness and love and compassion on my part. And I didn't offer her the same. I didn't honor that in the way she honored it with me when I offered it. The other example I'll give is that at when I did it's now been about 6 years ago, but I did a big house cleaning inventory, and I've done some smaller ones since, but this was a big inventory across the board. And I was surprised to discover in all three areas of investigation, in the resentments and the fears and in the conduct in sex, and not bad sexual behavior, but in the way that aspect of my life, where the spot that was holding in my brain, that in all three areas, pride was the primary defect of character. And going into that inventory, I would not have told you that was the big chunk of truth that I had to swallow and digest. And as I shared this inventory with my sponsor and told him, I said, "I just did not see this pride." And he said, "Steve, pride can't spot pride. You can't see pride through prideful eyes. It is camouflage to pride." He said, "But I imagine if you asked around, other people weren't having near the problem seeing it that you were." And I did, and they weren't. And so it is surprising what we learn about ourselves. But here's the thing, as uncomfortable and disappointing and embarrassing as that discovery was, I have two options. I can either go, "No, that you're wrong. That's not true," and push it away. And then I'm stuck with it. And our friend Bob B says, if there's a problem you're unwilling to have, you'll have it forever. And so I had to be willing to have this problem, to own that, and then move forward into step 6 and 7 and do some amend work around people I'd hurt with that pride. And so that's a couple of ways that this ego continues to show up well into, and as other people have said, what that is in itself a sign of immaturity. It is, it's, you know, we'll talk a lot about spiritual growth, but as we've been told many times, we're actually in spiritual kindergarten. And I perhaps just still in preschool. I'm aspirational toward kindergarten with you spiritual giants on here. But that's a couple that showed up for me. June, you might have an example you want to give, or you may want to kick this hour off another direction.
You know, when I try to think of a couple of things, you know, one of the things that comes up in my mind is, for example, there have been times in my life with raising my daughters where I really wanted to help them with whatever it was that was going on. And sometimes someone else is better able to help them. And my ego, I have to watch out and ask myself, you know, does my ego want to try and take credit for helping them if I can't do it as well as someone else? And sometimes my ego does. My ego says, well, you know, I mean, you want to be the one. I want to be the one. You know, a mom should be the one that can do this. And I have to step back and go, no, I want them to get maximum help. That's what I really want. Same thing being true of people that I sponsor or people that I work with in AA. You know, it does feel nice to be able to know that you have helped someone. But if someone else can be of greater help to them, I want to be able to step back. I want to be able to not say something. One of the little exercises that I've been aware of this last year or so, I don't know, maybe even during the pandemic, it just started to occur to me. And it's not as easy as you might think, or at least it's not as easy for me, I should say. And that is to not correct people who are wrong with little trivial things, so that they say, I love, you know, that this line in the big book, and they quote it and they go, and it's on page 63. I got 61. It's on page 61. Okay. So what's really important? Is it important what they're sharing about that they got from the big book, or is it more important that June corrects them on what the page number is? And, you know, it's those kind of things. I can remember I had this conversation once with somebody years ago, a very dear friend of mine. And I said something about this town in New York. I was telling him about, I was, you know, really interested in, you know, reading something about this town in New York. And he was from New York. And I later found out that the town I was talking to him about for like a half an hour at dinner, you know, not just the town, but these different things about this book and this story that I had read and blah, blah, blah. The town I was talking about was in New Jersey. He never corrected me. And I've thought a lot about that. I mean, he clearly knew that I was talking about New Jersey, not New York. And he could have straightened me out, you know, but he didn't. And I think that that's a spiritual exercise with my ego. When someone has something happening for them that's working, that I don't correct them to make it technically right, you know, to show that I know just a little bit more. I just want to let you know that, you know, I mean, because what is the value in that? I'm really trying to tear down, you know, what they're doing. I mean, it makes me think of this other story, which I think about a lot and I share about sometimes. So in 1981, I was at a conference with a guy named John V, as in victory. That's not his last name, but it's John V. And you could get his tapes or listen to his talks if you ever had any interest in doing that, because the tapers do have it. And I'm just going to tell you a little bit about John. So John was a Mi'kmaq Indian. He's from Canada. He grew up on a reservation. And he was one of, I think, 9 children. And when he was a little boy, 7 of the brothers and sisters and both of his parents died of tuberculosis on the reservation. And at that time, nobody really understood how tuberculosis was transmitted. Everybody on the reservation was terrified, and they asked John and his sister, who were, you know, I think like 12 years old, to leave the reservation because they had to protect everyone. And so John left, and he had a few different jobs, you know, as a dishwasher in his life. He started his drinking. He went from the Canadian Army when he got out straight to Skid Row. And that's where he did all of his drinking. He had no education. When he got to the program, he couldn't read or write. And he went to a mission, and he would go to missions often because it was a place to sleep indoors. And he was back in, you know, the New York area, and it was cold in the winter. So back then, maybe that's still true. A lot of missions today, when you went to the mission, if you wanted to spend the night, they would have a mandatory meeting that you had to go to. Sometimes it was a church service. Sometimes it was whatever. It was some kind of a meeting. So he went, you had to go to that if you wanted a bed. So he went to that meeting, the mandatory meeting of, you know, some kind of a religious group or whatever at the Salvation Army. And a guy came in to the meeting who was someone that he had drank with. And John had wine sores all over, and, you know, he was a mess. And this guy came in and he looked really good. And they started to talk. And the guy said, "John, I'm sober." And he said, "John, would you like to go to a meeting?" And John said, "No," because he'd already been to the meeting he had to go to. So he already had a bed. So what would he want to go to another meeting for? And the guy said, "They have donuts." And John said, "Okay, I'll go." So he went to his first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. He never drank again. And he has this amazing story that I really encourage you to, you know, get a chance and listen to. But one of the things that he shared about was this guy who came and picked him up to take him to that first meeting. He picked him up every day for weeks and took him to a meeting. And when he would show up, he came with a lunch bag with a sandwich in it. And he said, "John," he said, "my wife made me this sandwich, and it really hurts her feelings if I don't finish it. And I can only eat half of the sandwich. So I was wondering, John, if you would help me out and eat half of the sandwich so that my wife won't get her feelings hurt." And so John helped him out every night, eating half of that sandwich. And he said he was sober many, many years before he realized that this man was actually eating dinner every night with his family. And he was bringing that sandwich and offering John half because he knew if he gave John the whole sandwich, John's pride would not have let him take a whole sandwich. But because the way that he suggested that John to John that he help him, John was willing and able to take half of that sandwich. And I thought about how many times people in this program have shown kindnesses to me, not from way up on high, you know, but from just looking right in the eye, you know, just how can we help, and including me. And I also have found over the years that it's been very important for me to look back and think of these people and their kindnesses, not all just in AA. A lot of them were the foster homes that I lived in and, you know, the different people that kind of kept me alive until I got to the program. And think of ways where I needed to go back and say thank you. It's sort of a different kinds of an amends, but it's a way of, you know, of recognizing the contribution. I made contact with the vice principal at my junior high, who I am quite sure did not remember me, but I remembered her because when the police came to take me into custody and put me in more foster homes, before they got there that day, she went to the store and she bought me she bought me some clothes with her own money. And I always thought about that. You know, that wasn't part of her job. And I had not done anything, I assure you, at that school with my attitude and my drinking to, you know, encourage anyone to be kind. But she sent me into that, you know, foster home with a couple of brand new items of underwear and clothing. And I had not ever had that. And just about 3 years ago now, I tried to find her, and a friend of mine helped me find her, and I wrote her a card. And I just said, I just wanted to thank you. And I'm sure you probably got a lot of letters of people thanking you. And actually, believe it or not, she didn't. As the junior high vice principal, she said she'd never gotten a card. And we've sort of developed a friendship, and we've gone out a few times, you know, for lunch, and I send her a card every once in a while, and she always answers me right away. So just, you know, just again, just thinking of, you know, of those kind of things. One more thing that I'll segue into before I thought I might tell you later on some more things that Chuck C had said to me. But another thing that I had read this little spiritual story, and it was about the way that we let people help us and how that's another way that we say thank you. And I have a very hard time letting people help me, because I like to do it myself. And so when I read this story about that, I realized how many thousands of times I have robbed people of a moment of happiness that I could have let them have by helping me in whatever way, by opening a door, you know, by saving me a seat at a meeting, or by giving me a call or something like that. And I just go, no, I've got it. You know, or giving me a ride. No, thank you. I'll take the bus, or I'll walk, or I'll, you know, wait for my car to be ready. I can do it myself. And right after I read this story, I traveled and I went to see a woman I sponsor in Florida, and we got there, and her and her husband came out and gave me a hug. And then I opened my trunk to get my suitcase out, and he goes, oh, you know, let me get that for you. And I go, no, I can get it. Because of course I can get it. I mean, it's my suitcase. I go everywhere with the suitcase. Obviously I can't have a suitcase that I couldn't get myself. And I was able to stop myself, and I was able to say, thank you. Now, I don't think that that changed his life forever, you know, that I let him carry my suitcase. But I know that there was a moment where I let him in my life, and I let him do something for me that mattered that at that moment. And so I've really tried. It's an effort for me. I try to be aware of asking for help, or letting people help when they offer, and saying thank you. Anyway, I'll let Steve chat for a while.